We're on to 2021.
Cats, better than 1917.
You are a Criterion charlatan.
Armando, I'm canceling your cancel.
This Taylor Swift Netflix documentary is a straight-up masterpiece.
You only watched 32 films this year. The Letterboxd Mafia is not pleased.
This is one of the year's best films, and it's buried inside the Netflix algorithm.
What is it about Shia LaBeouf's artistic expression that you find so threatening?
Did he seriously watch Richard Jewell, or is this a troll?
My taste just happened to be off the beaten path.
This one is on multiple streaming services. You have no excuse.
Justice for Lupita, justice for Gerwig.
Dumont is inescapable. Coin is undeniable.
Are you feeling this? Are you feeling the way I'm feeling right now? What's up, everybody? You're listening to the Third Act Podcast, episode number 172. I am your host, Christian Esterbrook, and with me as always is Jericho Sorona.
Oh, man, I forgot my soul glow and my hair is looking mad ragged.
And Armando Rivera.
She urinates on me. She laughs as she pees. I just lie there. I don't make a sound.
All right, dear listeners, we're reminding you that all of us here at the Third Act Podcast, we watch a lot of films, we have a lot of opinions on those films, and we're just pretentious enough to think that you care. Oh my goodness, it's good to be back. A regular episode, new movie, old movie, filmography, all three hosts. Woo! Good times, good times.
The three cinematic amigos back in the saddle.
Now, tell us, Romano, what really has been going on? I was talking to Christian last episode about you really pumping out those reports for old man Leland, just doing that overtime. And is this a real thing? Are you covering? Is there some other issues going on in your life that you're creating this whole mysterious kind of second job, being very busy and stressed out sort of mythos?
Yeah,
we got a regular Oprah Winfrey Meghan Markle situation here.
Whoa.
Asking the tough questions.
Yeah, I didn't want to bring this up, but you guys are putting me on the spot, so you're not tipping my, you're forcing my hand here. I've been talking to some people. Uh-oh. There's been some offers or some other podcasts.
Oh, no.
This is an old joke. Dude, yeah. I remember this from like 2015.
I don't remember doing this. No.
Where's the Simmons reference? Is there a Simmons reference coming?
No. Have I done this bit before? I don't think so.
Yeah. Yes, in so many words. Not exactly this, what you're doing now, but.
But something about joining another podcast?
Yeah.
I need some hard evidence because I'm not remembering this, but it's possible. I'm not ruling it out. No, just, neck deep in work, just adjusting. But, it's great to be back. It's really good to be back. And, we're back with the bang. Another 80s banger, which I guess is up my alley, right? Which is another running joke, 80s. But
80s stuff.
Nice deflection.
I want the audio. We find the clip. I'm not believing it until I hear the clip.
Any cinematic travails that got you through the work, or have you just ignored film altogether, and then now it's like you're coming out of the tunnel and Eddie Murphy's there to take your hand and welcome you back?
Oh boy, let's see. Over the past couple weeks, not a lot to speak of. I mean, I could mention
the NBA All-Star game.
That's usually Cinema. A hard pass. That's a hard pass for me. There was a recent date night-ish rewatch of Four Weddings and a Funeral. Damn, is that Hugh Grant charming. And I don't know if you guys remember that one, but other than that, no.
That's the only one. So, all right.
Yeah, I mean, if they come to mind, I'll bring them up. I'll try to shoehorn them into one of the reviews. But yeah, Is Nomadland, do I need to see? I mean, I didn't give my thoughts on some of the other films, at least not on air, right? But I did see a couple. What was the one I missed? Three nights in Miami.
One night. Well, if
we like... have a lot to talk about, it was three nights.
Yeah, it was just the one night. It felt like I was subjected to 72 hours in Miami
You don't have a lot kind to say, so let's skip over that. But I am anxious if we can get a little bit more serious here for a moment. You probably didn't listen. Jericho and I did two episodes without you. We did the One Night in Miami / Connection episode, and then we did a But Does It Hold Up about a week and a half ago. But the Connection, Jericho and I both big fans on. I'm out here dropping the M word, 5 stars.
Wow. Yeah.
Like for me, that was a huge. I watched it twice before we recorded, and I think it's one of the best films of all time. So. I don't want to lead too much as I ask this, but any thoughts on the Connection? Did that one hit for you?
Wow.
Oh yeah.
Is it a wow film?
I don't think I'm quite on your level 10 out of 10, but I mean it's definitely in the ahead of its time. This is some innovative stuff, you know, Beat Generation vibe. So I definitely dug that, and the Does It Hold Up? That was Drop Dead Fred, right? And what was the other one? What was the other
Opportunity
pick?
Knocks?
Oh, which,
have you even heard of that? The Dana Carvey movie?
Never seen that one. I was a Carvey guy, but I haven't seen that one. Drop Dead Fred, I kind of remember liking that one, but just hearing about that kind of made me want to get back into the Does It Hold Up business. So,
well, we're kind of doing that this episode. Segue. Yeah. There's a new release movie called Coming to America. It's a sequel to a movie called Coming to America. And then for autobiography, we have two deaths. This is a very two episode, guys. Coming to America, two deaths.
Mm-hmm.
See this?
Does not take place in America. It takes place in Romania, I think.
True.
Two deaths in Romania.
Are they in... Fuck, I was going to... What's the country from Zamunda? Damn it. I was like, it's something with a Z. If I get it wrong, I'm going to sound like an ass. So I just fumbled instead. I did real good as Zamunda for that one. Damn it. I fucked it up. Let's scrap it. Let's start
you
over,
blew
guys.
It. You blew it, bud.
Blew it. Cut the tape. God damn it. But yeah, we have a de facto But Does It Hold Up episode, kind of, as we're getting back to it. So our pairing film is in reverse. Let's talk about the first one first. Coming to America from 1998, directed by John Landis. This one stars Eddie Murphy, Paul Bates, and Garcelle Beauvau. The synopsis: an extremely pampered African prince travels to Queens, New York, and goes undercover to find a wife that he can respect for her intelligence and strong will. I like that synopsis from IMDb. Thank you for that. I mentioned But Does It Hold Up, which is a bonus episode we've done a couple of times now of movies from any of our youths, things we watched as children, as young people, and now we're revisiting it decades later to see if it holds up. I'm assuming that's going to be the case for both of you. Do you guys both watch Coming to America, years and years ago, and then... had a long gap before seeing it for this episode. Is that right?
Sure,
Armando, let's start with you. Armando, Coming to America. You saw this as a kid, right?
Yeah, dozens and dozens and dozens of times.
This is a big one for you. Is this a staple? Is this like a formative one for you, would you say?
Yeah, totally. I mean, this came out in the late 80s. This is right in that sweet spot where... HBO's a thing, and I'm at that age, and this is just on one of those that's just on constantly, right? I mean, even into the early 90s, and I don't even think this, so it applies in that sense. I don't know if it's one that I haven't seen, in like 20 years or anything like that. I mean, I don't know how long it's been since I've seen it all the way through, but it's kind of one of those where I flip and I'll you know, I'll put on, you know, oh, it's this scene, and I'll watch for a little while. So, yeah, not one of those where I was totally wondering, oh, how is this going to play this, you know, this much longer. But it's, yeah, it's so ingrained, you know, I know how every scene's going to unfold, the, you know, the quotes. I mean, yeah, it was a big thing in my youth.
Jericho, was this a big one for you back in the day?
Not really a big one, but I did watch it and have fond memories of it. It wasn't a HBO staple. I didn't have HBO. So it was one of those VHS ones and, you know, kind of really, very popular movie. You know, was a nominal Eddie Murphy fan, but not one of those Golden Goose, not Drop Dead Fred by any means for me. So I remember liking it. I remember liking it back then, but honestly, and this is different than Armando, is that I have not seen it since I was very young. So
yeah,
clips, you know, little broken up clips on YouTube or whatever, just little bits and pieces. But in terms of, yeah, like actually watching the movie from beginning to end, it's been a very long time. So this was going to be interesting because I know I'm just thinking late 80s. It's going to be a lot of dated, problematic stuff going on.
We'll get into it.
Yeah. And speaking of that, too, I think later on in life, we'll speak. Okay, before I get to that, Jericho, but did you go back and check out Siskel and Ebert's take on this? Did you watch the review? I know you did, or had you?
Not right after. I remember. I know Siskel was a huge fan, and Ebert was not having it.
Right.
I haven't rewatched their review. I mean, I saw it like probably a year ago or something when I was going through the archives. But I do remember it stands out.
Yeah, and I also think just going back to, you know, how much time was in between viewings and all that. I think because, you know, I you know, at that age, I was not really privy to Eddie Murphy's stand-up, right, which is pretty profane. It's, you know, some of those classic early performances. So
probably
I think,
doesn't hold up.
Well, I mean, some of the subject matter, you know, very problematic, but certain bits definitely. And I think even Eddie Murphy would express some regret. But and I think, you know, later in life, getting into stand up and then, you know, listening to his stuff, among others, I think I'm sure I probably, you know, sometime in my 20s then went back and watched some of those Eddie Murphy flicks, this one. But yeah, I think this had been the first time in years that I had watched it all the way through. So
so Armando asked me before we started recording and I declined, denied until now, to say that this was my first time ever seeing Coming to America. I'd never seen it before. Didn't know even that much about it. I mean, Jericho said,
wow,
you know, seen clips from time to time. I recognize at least one shot from this movie, which still lives on in GIF and meme form of Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall's mouths dropping open while they're in a nightclub. That that is still, you know, quite common online, but never seen it. And I'm not sure. I mean, I guess I know how I missed this one. I had a pretty solid 80s movie education from my parents as far as like mainstream genre or comedy movies from the 80s. Those were big. We were a big movie household growing up. But this one, I think, crossed the risque line a little too much, you know, as a kid and all the stuff that, you know, my parents were showing us. They'd want to stay more in that PG-13 range. This one, you got some nudity, you got some, you know, you got some blue humor in here for sure. So I think, you know, but by the time my parents would have been comfortable showing this to us, it just never came up. So we missed it. We missed out on. Well, I don't know. I assume my siblings didn't watch this one either. I was the oldest. So somehow missed this one. I did watch Beverly Hills Cop with my parents. I remember that. So the Eddie Murphy, you know, being inappropriate for children line was crossed, you know, sometimes, but not for this one, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know, remains to be seen. So I watched it for the first time. Jericho kind of hinted at it a little bit for him revisiting this, but honestly, after a while, once it got, you know, to the point where I'm making my own movie watching decisions, it never seemed like something that I needed to go back to watch Coming to America. I knew it was well liked. I knew it was very popular. I looked up before this episode. This movie was a huge hit, like $300 million in the 80s. This thing was fucking massive, massive hit. But I'm like, man, I know about some, you know, we already brought up Eddie Murphy's like stand up. It's the 80s. This is one of the R-rated ones. It's also like a cultural thing. Like, you know, he plays an African character. It's just like, man, I was just kind of bracing and it never really thinking that this was going to be something that was a slam dunk. That's one of the most surprising things. Maybe my biggest response to this, watching it for the first time in the last week, is how the degree to which it's problematic is much lower than I was fearing. Much lower. I mean, even the synopsis says it. I mean, there's certainly some questionable decisions in here, you know, about how female characters are depicted or treated, for sure. But I mean, the whole point of the movie is Eddie Murphy doesn't want, you know, a woman in his life that is just going to, you know, worship him and go along with, you know, anything that's his beck and call. He wants someone who he's attracted to intellectually as well as physically, and won't do everything that he says. And it seems trite as I'm bringing it up now, but that's a pretty big surprise. Like, I was not anticipating. I didn't know what this movie was about. I didn't know that there was like a romantic element to this at all. I had expected, I mean, from the title, it's pretty obvious. I thought this was going to be a lot of fish out of water type stuff. Visiting America. Is this going to be like Borat? Is he just going to get into, you know, weird cultural things with people? You know, the whole time I didn't know for sure, but I didn't even know that there was like a romance element of it. So, I mean, that's kind of the shocking thing. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know where you guys were, you know, where this hit, like, you know, where the needle was pinging for you guys. But revisiting this, weren't you bracing for there to be more cringy things watching this in 2021, watching this late 80s movie?
Yeah, I was. I mean, there were definitely some moments. But, yeah, I don't think it completely... you know, it was just large chunks of stuff where it's like, this would definitely not play today. This movie would not get made. It wasn't as bad as I thought.
And I mean, I will say, I think that this movie has a pretty great energy to it. I think that, you know, you get the introduction of these characters in... God, why can't I... Zamunda. I don't know why that is not on the tip of my tongue. You get the introduction of all these characters in the country of Zamunda, and obviously it's so, you know, the jokes are very big and broad. You have the, you know, bring in the royal wipers, like all these ridiculous things, you know, not super deep jokes, but definitely some chuckles along the way. But there's some real moments in this that work for me. I mean, a highlight for sure, when Eddie Murphy meets what is, you know, expected to be his bride, his arranged marriage. And then this, like, you know, I don't know who this page or servant, this right hand man guy, out of nowhere starts singing this She's Your Queen to Be song in this very high falsetto as she's walking in the room. Oh, it killed. It killed. That was that brought the house down for me. And so, you know, there's some moments that sneak up. And even though the movie, it's very broad humor, and it, you know, and it works on a very kind of surface level often, there's some jokes that sneak up on me. There's some well-constructed stuff, too. I think my favorite joke in the movie is after a certain part. So, you know, for those who haven't seen or don't remember, Eddie Murphy is rejecting his arranged marriage. He wants to go to America. He wants to go to New York specifically, find a woman who, you know, will love him for him, doesn't know that he's a prince and that he finds interesting as well as attractive, and, you know, wants to actually fall in love with someone. So they both go. They're in, you know, kind of regular street clothes. That's another thing I loved. I love the kind of giddy, dorky Eddie Murphy in that pinned New York Mets jacket which is probably like an iconic thing now since the movie is so popular. But man, I love that look. That was great when they first changed clothes the first time. Love that. So they are, where was I going? So they're there and they're undercover and they're trying to find, trying to meet people and find people and be completely inconspicuous. What was the scene I was just about to fucking bring up? God damn it. I totally fucking lost. Oh. So part of their undercover bit is they go to work at McDowell's, which is an obvious McDonald's ripoff. Again, very broad. I laughed. It was funny. They're Big Mick burgers and everything about this is just slightly different than McDonald's. That kind of worked for me. But they start there and, you know, they're mopping floors. They're doing all this stuff. And then there's another one of the like big highlights, this holdup scene where Samuel Jackson comes in, eyes bulging, looks coked out of his mind, and Eddie Murphy saves the day. And then the owner or manager of the McDowell's restaurant comes out to the two of them, is like, you guys, you know, you really did a number in there. You know, you guys impressed me. Make sure you're free Sunday night. You're coming to my house. We're having a party.
Yeah.
And then smash cut to them in these like bright red jackets. And they're the what's it called? They're the valet for the party. That was just great joke construction and timing. I thought that worked perfectly. So, I mean, there's a variety of stuff. I mean, there's tons of stuff that doesn't work. I think Eddie Murphy getting jerked off during a basketball game, that was very unfunny. I don't know if this is, you know, one of those things where they're just, you know, trying to push the envelope. They're trying to be risque or whatever. Doesn't work. It's more the innocent, kind of gleeful stuff that really hit for me. Like, when Eddie Murphy goes to the bathroom and there's this guy standing in line and he recognizes him because he's from Zamunda and he's like begging for a picture. And then he's like bowing to him and then, you know, his love interest. And then they see this guy like freaking out to meet him. I don't know. There's something so innocent about that. There's no target. It's not mean humor. It's this really kind of corny, but also just really wholesome humor that I just totally wasn't prepared for at all. That's another moment that just works. It's just great. This movie has plenty of that in it. And there's the things that would become kind of Eddie Murphy staples. Murphy and Arsenio Hall both play multiple characters. It looks pretty great. I think this is probably the best use of that out of any of these movies. I think once you get to like Nutty Professor in the sequel, there's like some CG work to do those body transformations. This looks incredible. It has like famous makeup artist Rick Baker doing these masks that they're in. They look pretty incredible. I had trouble I had to look it up in the credits. I was like, which one of them is playing this Jewish guy? I can't even tell who it is. Apparently that was Eddie Murphy, but I was like, that face mask, whatever he's wearing, is so good. I can't even tell. And the voice work is so good. I can't even really tell. I know it must be one of them, but it wasn't obvious. And I think it's some of the best stuff like that, where it brings an energy, but it also doesn't overpower the movie, where those types of jokes become the entire movie. Maybe the Arsenio Hall in drag is one of the things that, you know, doesn't quite work a couple decades later, but I don't know, for the most part I found this pretty quaint. And for me kind of going into this bracing for this to not really hold up, not be something that is really palatable at this point, I was surprised at how easy this movie is to go along. I think it's well-paced, especially in the first half with a lot of the jokes. The humor definitely dies out in the second half when the romance kind of plot becomes the primary motivation of the movie. But, you know, it's sweet enough. You know, it's fine for a romantic comedy, especially in the first half. I think there's enough jokes to carry it as a comedy. And, you know, the romance is fine. Yeah, I'm pleasantly surprised. I'm glad to finally have caught up with Coming to America. Armando, this was a major one for you. You said you've seen this dozens of times. So what did you think on this most recent visit?
Yeah, and it was wildly popular and successful. You know, I don't know if it's something that's necessarily widely regarded as a comedy classic, but you're, you know, I don't know. I'm not saying you said that, but But yeah, it, you know, and this was kind of at Eddie Murphy's peak, right? Where he's, you know, kind of full-fledged movie star at this point. I think this was like even his, maybe his story, his concept. I don't think he's officially listed as a screenwriter, but and there was, I think he was even talks to possibly directing this, but I think he'd worked with Landis before. And actually, timeline-wise, Jericho, was this before Harlem Nights, right?
Yeah, Harlem Nights was a couple early 90s. Yeah. But yeah, he worked with Landis in Trading Places in the early 80s.
Another one I haven't seen.
And I guess there's this whole, they had a whole feud too.
Yeah.
Landis and Murphy. And I guess Murphy claimed he like saved Landis's career by offering him this directing job because Landis had like a string of flops. And then there was that whole fiasco with the Twilight Zone movie.
Yeah, and I know Murphy made a joke about it, like, you know, I have as much, you know, I'm as likely to work with Landis as insert the name of the guy who died in that movie. It was like his joke, but yeah, and so this is kind of on the cusp of like, you know, and that's, you know, Harlem at that time was like full fledged, like, you know, I'm gonna direct this, and it's just, you know, and that was, you know, kind of fell flat, but you know, SNL, you know, post stand up, and so. You know, and I think this might be his first film where it's kind of, you know, he's playing this sort of romantic lead, and he's not, I mean, aside from the, you know, the multiple characters that would become a staple of Eddie Murphy, which, and I also agree, to me, this is, even though, you know, I am partial somewhat to the, some of the Nutty Professor stuff, but I think this was, you know, it at its most effective, and it's freshest, obviously, and you know, and so he's kind of playing a bit of a different character here, in that, I mean, you know, when he's playing Akeem, you know, for the most part, he's a straight man. There's some goofy antics here and there, but, you know, he's mostly reacting. And it's kind of cool hearing, you know, some of these, because like I said, so this is one of those that I kind of enjoyed so much as a kid, and, you know, you're not, you know, as a kid, you know, you don't have the most discerning taste. And so some of these jokes and bits were ones that, you know, you kind of get to with certain movies where even if it's, you know, not as good as you remembered, or you know, as adults, something will play so much, you kind of get, you had so many laughs out of it that it's like kind of the nostalgia factor kind of kicks in a little bit, and you can't help but continue to laugh at some of it, you know, at some of it. Might not play as much, like it's so ingrained, but it was kind of cool to hear you know, Christian reacting to this for the first time, like, you know, like the, you know, that cut, that instant cut, it just made me laugh, you know. And then he's like the valet, and then he brings the guy in, he brings Akeem in to serve drinks, you know. And and to me, it's just, what jumps out here is that yes, there's some regrettable material, Eddie Murphy, the stand-up bits, you know, we don't have to get into, you know, Raw and Delirious, and there, you know, there's homophobic bits, plenty of misogyny, but there's no doubt, just going back, that he's extremely talented. I mean, yeah, you know, even if some of the subject matter is definitely regrettable, I mean, he's very gifted, and even here, you know, I'm not saying this is you know, Academy Award, you know, worthy performances or anything, but just another thing that jumped out to me was that he's convincing as Akeem, like this innocent, you know, I mean, in Eddie Murphy, all people, he's convincing as this, like, you know, innocent, naive 21-year-old, I guess, and Eddie Murphy does look younger than he is, but you know, young prince, and it's like this corny, hokey, you know, backbone of a story, you know, with kind of this, all this bombast and set pieces and performances, you know, laid on top of it, and he's convinced. And I think also what works, you know, what works the second time around, well, I mean, not a second time around, but after all these years, actually watching the movie again for the you know, all the way through, is that performance, the interplay between him and Arsenio Hall, who is also, I think, a very talented guy. I mean, he, you know, he kills some of the, and certain scenes fall flat. Like, I think, you know, the scene in the bar where, you know, where there's like they meet all these women, you know, that a couple of scenes like that fall a little flat. Didn't really bring the laughs as maybe they did before. But kind of their interplay there, you know, they met as stand-ups. They were actually friends. And also, I mean, it's corny, but I also kind of enjoyed the love story. I mean, it's super simple. It's, you know, there's information that's, you know, withheld and they got to overcome this obstacle. And it's totally predictable and formulaic. But I think it works because, you know, Sherry Heedley, who plays Lisa McDowell, there's some chemistry. Now, there's like an actual sweetness to some of the scenes, you know, and we get the obligatory lame boyfriend who has like no redeeming qualities. And so it's a very, very warm handoff to the really idealistic, pairing with Akeem, you know, that they're meant to be. It's all very hokey, but it kind of works. And also too, I think this is one of those movies that also felt really grand and huge, as a kid, this big production, you know, Zamunda, then, you know, when we get the credits, we get, you know, they come back to, you know, to the whole cast. And so it just, and, you know, I'm not saying Landis is some kind of amazing director, but, you know, I think the kind of the scope of, you know, in Zamunda and, you know, some of the set pieces are, you know, they're ridiculous, they're over the top, but it still feels big. It still feels like a big kind of grand production, and this Zamunda place exists, and you do feel, you know, the regalness and kind of the scope of this life that he's living. So I think it's also kind of fairly well directed, and I could go back and forth on some of the scenes that then endure. I mean, I think the multiple characters works, the sexual talk, the soul glow stuff, the Coming to America theme, which also going back, I never realized that Nile Rodgers did the music for it, did the soul glow theme, did the Coming to America theme. You know, there's a sense of fun here. You know, John Amos is on board. Samuel Jackson, that seems funny. And also too, I know when Christian mentioned the scene that, you know, that he's seen multiple times with, you know, them, you know, kind of hanging, dropping their jaws in disbelief. I thought Christian was going to mention the yes, fuck you too from the balcony scream, which, yeah, I think is still classic. The soul glow, Jerry Curl stuff, even like smaller moments, smaller, funnier moments too, kind of worked for me. Like, you know, just the likability of Murphy just playing this, you know, this corny, hokey, fish out of water guy when they're in church and everything's going crazy. And all of a sudden it stops for a second. He jumps and says, "I am having a good time." It's just like, I like, you know, that stuff. It's just a really funny movie to me, even as some of the stuff is a bit dated. It's a bit 80s. There's a couple of problematic gags here that are just, you know, a little bit poor taste. And, you know, I'm not a prude about that stuff, but it, you know, don't quite hold up. It's not as funny when you're an adult, but I still had a really good time. And I think the arc of the movie is actually kind of satisfying, because to me, even as it got serious and some of the laughs cut back, I actually also enjoyed the love story. So like the arc of the movie actually worked for me too. So, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that this is a great film, capital F, but I really enjoy it. I really think it works as a comedy and a corny, sort of sweet minor love story. Even if, you know, I'm not saying I'm super, super invested in that or anything, but I think the movie still works and it's still a lot of fun.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Jericho, are we being too positive here? Are you gonna get us to take us down a peg here, or are you gonna lend your voice to the choir on the original Coming to America?
My intention is never to kill the buzz at the party or join a choir. So maybe I'll slip somewhere in between those two extremes. By the way, Harlem Nights, 1989.
So the year after.
The next year, Eddie Murphy gets to direct a film with his mentor, Richard Pryor, and I've seen it, and it's awful. But looking at this movie, Coming to America, in context, now, a lot of this stuff flew over my head, you know, as a kid, but like, this is a big Hollywood studio movie with an all black cast, right? I think that was pretty rare, if unheard of, in the 80s. I mean, you had stuff like, I guess, the Cosby Show on TV, but I can see this as a cultural landmark for black audiences. Like, if you're black and you're of a certain age when this came out, I'm sure that's a huge part of why this thing was such a gigantic hit, because it is so singular just from that perspective.
Yeah. I mean, and for Louis Anderson fans.
Yeah. Oh, and a quick
thing. No one mentioned Louis Anderson yet. Is probably the best scene in the whole movie.
Yeah. Now I'm on lettuce. And then the big bucks start coming in. But yeah, just a quick interject. I think Eddie Murphy was on Kill Mushroom and Arsenio. And he was saying, like, they made him hire Louis Anderson, who, in fairness, who he liked, but just to have like one white guy
one
in.
One white person. So, you know, and like Armando was saying, Eddie Murphy at this point, huge star, bankable. This thing was always going to make money. But I mean, watching it now, I found this to be a rather tame, wholesome take on his persona. This is something that Christian talked about, which is also surprising to me because I think this is rated R. And I just remember it being like a lot. I don't want to say edgier, because that's not the right term, but
raunchier,
maybe more off color. Yeah. And today, watching it in 2021, the movie feels very quaint. You guys use the word corny. It's very corny. But there's a warmth to it, to the performances, that I think keeps it watchable. You know, you have Prince Akeem, the heir to the Zumanda throne. It's like a less flashy version of the usual Murphy type. He does have that magnetic smile. He's got the charm, but he doesn't have any of that raw edge that you would expect from him in this time period. But he does get to do a little bit of that disrespectable comedy by playing these various characters in the Rick Baker makeup at the barbershop. Which is essentially channeling his like SNL skit character stuff. And he would later recycle that, as Christian mentioned, in like the Nutty Professor movies and beyond. But and this wasn't one of my childhood favorites. I remember it fondly, I guess. But somehow in my mind, I thought this is more like laugh out loud, kind of slapstick, like edgy comedy type of movie. And it isn't. It's a gentle sort of fish out of water comedy with like a romantic subplot, which I had completely forgotten about that. And it's got this great supporting cast. You guys have went through them all. Arsenio Hall, John Amos as the owner of the McDowell's, James Earl Jones as Murphy's father, Sherry Headley as Amos's daughter and the object of Prince Akeem's desires, Eric LaSalle. I know he's in the posters and in the video for the Soul Glow Perm product, but he's actually in a couple scenes too, and I think is pretty good in the few moments he has that I found to be pretty comedic. All these characters have their little moments: Sam Jackson, Louis Anderson. And on a positive, on a very positive note, I actually think this movie looks pretty good. I mean, the colors pop, and particularly the costumes are amazing. In the scenes, particularly in Africa. Just really well done costumes and set design. And of course, the juxtaposition of what Murphy and Arsenio Hall are wearing when they show up in Queens. I mean, it's an easy joke, but I mean, some of their costuming is just like incredible to look at. But the thing about this movie, watching it now, is, and I know this is very subjective, but I just don't think it's that funny. Like, there's that moment of the high-pitched singing that Christian mentioned, and a few scenes with Louis Anderson. Those are the only scenes that I actually laughed during. I kind of had a smile on my face throughout, and it was a couple like, sort of mild chortles or whatever. But in terms of laughs, two moments where I actually laughed out loud. So I think that's kind of a problem for what I thought was a comedy. But I think this is pretty much, it's a serviceable, silly, kind of slow-paced 80s genre movie. It's fine, I think. It's truly unobjectable, other than some of the blatant misogyny and a couple other scenes that Christian had pointed to, like the one in the nightclub or the hand job scene. But for me, it didn't really work as just a straight-up comedy. And I think John Landis here, no one's going to say he's Orson Welles, but he just feels like his direction is very detached. He's shooting everything in like medium to wide shots. There's really no forward momentum to the camera work. I mean, it's basically fine boilerplate 80s direction. So besides the look of the
sequel, though.
Yeah, with the look of the film, like the actual cinematography, the way it looks, like the film grain and everything, the colors look great. So I think the cinematography is actually good. I just don't think the direction is anything to write home about. So, I mean, does the movie work? I think kinda. Is it funny? To me, not really. But Murphy, Hall, Amos, all these guys, these characters, these are like actors and people I like to see. So it kind of keeps it going. It keeps it watchable. I mean, basically, though, this is a prince looking for his princess movie. I mean,
yeah.
The racial element kind of keeps this movie more interesting, I guess. But structurally, it's a very trite kind of age-old scenario. And even though, you know, Murphy wants a woman who's going to think on her own and not be a robot, he's still going out of his way, going to another country to find his princess. I don't know. It still seems kind of retrograde in that sense. But you know, putting Murphy and Hall into these roles and stripping away the white characters, aside from Louis Anderson, or like how black characters are responding to whiteness, that is an inversion that I think is interesting, at least, or it makes the movie, watching it now, a little more fascinating than I thought it would be. So I think those elements, the actors, the cinematography, the costumes, the lack of whiteness, I think that stuff is all really successful and compelling. But I got to say, I just didn't laugh enough. Like, I didn't think it was funny enough for me to really recommend it as a comedy. But, you know, there's other pleasures here. So I think it's okay.
Okay. Okay. Took us down a little bit, but yeah, you mentioned something that I wanted to highlight real quick before we move on. It feels kind of shocking to me to go to an Eddie Murphy movie in the 80s. You know, he's playing a bunch of different characters in makeup, and the movie feels like paced out. You know, it doesn't feel... And it's from the director, John Landis. Like, I think of Blues Brothers. But does it hold up? I haven't seen that in forever. But Blues Brothers feels like a movie where it's all about momentum. It's always about moving. Yeah. And it's really high energy. And it's you know, bouncing off the walls at all times. You know, with that director and this star and this time period and the type of comedy that this seems to be going for, this seems like something that's going to be spinning out of control most of the time. And it's not. And I think that's such a wild thing for you guys to rediscover, I guess, that this movie actually really takes its time for most of it, even in the funnier parts of the movie or the more comedic parts. You know, your mileage will vary when it comes to how funny it actually is. But when it's going for comedy, even in those times, it's, you know, it is not just antics bouncing off the wall, screaming at you, or, you know, really, you know, forcing the energy. It's something that's kind of taken its time, which was a big surprise. And Sexual Chocolate, the band, hits. That's a hit for me.
I don't know. Like, a lot of that, like that character, even like Arsenio's like preacher character, I don't think any of that's that funny It's pretty basic, kind of dumb humor.
You didn't like the barbershop stuff?
It was okay. I didn't laugh at it. I mean, it was like, like I appreciated it, but nothing they were actually saying was funny. Like the personalities are kind of funny, but like the actual dialogue is like, not.
Yeah, it's amusing. It's like an amusing setup. You know, they're arguing about boxers. They can't remember anybody's names and things are coming to mind, blah, blah, blah. Talking about Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, One Night
like
in Miami
sitcom.
Reference.
It's like a sitcom humor. It doesn't, they don't do anything weird. Nothing unexpected happens. It's just very like cut to this guy reaction shot. He says his line like a sitcom and it didn't really, the makeup is awesome. I just was going on in those scenes aren't really funny.
But I liked, you know, some of the, you know, we talked about the fish out of water tropes. I thought some of those definitely worked. And I don't know, and I think the pacing of it, which I think that's what kind of makes it work for me, especially, you know, in the obligatory third act, it kind of gives that stuff a little more heft, like, you know, kind of taking its time with, you know, her, you know, him not wanting her to see his apartment and, you know, just stuff like that that could lag if the chemistry and sweetness wasn't there, kind of make it work overall. And, you know, this isn't like super cleverly written or anything. I'm not saying, definitely not saying that.
I do appreciate the pay that it's more languid. It's not this frenetic, like gags everywhere and things. It's not like watching fucking Airplane or something, you know, and I do appreciate that. However, I do think because of that pacing, because of the length of the film, it really like sags in the middle. Like the end picks up the beginning, the middle, it just drags. And is it like a 2-hour movie? Like this movie, to jump into the Armando's mortal phrases, you could have trimmed 30 minutes from this.
Well, not 30, but no,
not 30.
I think you make a really good point too about, you know, and I mean, at the time, I don't think it really hit me because I'm really young, but I think, you know, seeing this all black cast and, you know, as, you know, in a lot of role, I mean, as royalty, right? And must have been huge for the time. And also, I mean, in retrospect, I mean, to where we are now, not that we are completely where we need to be, but, you know, there's even some, you know, even that it is a little retrograde, I agree with, you know, he's going to catch himself, his princess. But, you know, she's given some agency too. And I think Sherry Headley is actually really good here. And, you know, and she's
I think the sister's really good, but she just doesn't have enough to do.
Right. Sherry Headley's really good. And, you know, and she's also strong character she's not going to be told how to live or what to do, you know. And so I think some of that, you know, it's not completely revolutionary or anything, but it's just kind of little nice little mini wrinkles in there.
I don't know, I think this movie's got good energy. I wasn't laughing, you know, for the whole near 2 hours. I mentioned the stuff that I found the most funny, but even if I'm not laughing out loud, the barbershop stuff, I mean, you compare that. I mean, I not to make the easy comparison, but like I haven't seen them since they came out, but I doubt those Nutty Professor movies hold up. You think about that like scene with all the Eddie Murphys around the table, you compare that to this barbershop, like you'll take this 10 times out of 10. Like this is definitely better. But even some of the quaint stuff, some of the Eddie Murphy corny stuff that Armando was talking about, like when he goes into the McDowell's, he's talking to the boss, he's like trying to talk about football and he like doesn't understand it, he's like, they kick it through the big H. Like obviously I'm not laughing out loud, I'm not like slapping my knee, but man, it's just good energy. It's got a good energy. It's an amusing movie. I failed in my note taking. I wrote something down, I don't always even take notes. I don't know what the hell, I totally just botched this. Tell me if this rings a bell. I wrote it in quotes, so this must have been something someone said. I'm guessing it's a laugh line, but I just have no memory of this. No different than the average man is what I wrote down. Like, what the fuck? That must have been something Eddie Murphy said, I guess, but
okay. Yeah.
I thought it was funny at the time, but I only watched this like 4 days ago, and I have no idea what the hell that was in reference to. Oh, well. Lost that one. All right. let's roll it on over. 2021, the sequel coming to America, the number two, guys. You see what they did there? Because the second movie coming to America, this time directed by Craig Brewer, again stars Eddie Murphy, Arsenio Hall, and newcomer Jermaine Fowler. The synopsis: the African monarch Akeem learns he has a long-lost son in the United States and must return to America to meet this unexpected heir and build a relationship with his son. So coming back 30-ish years later, this was supposed to be a big release around Christmas time, but obviously pandemic hit, so that didn't happen. So after the movie was already complete, Amazon bought the rights, so now it's streaming on Prime Video. I was gonna say pretty much, but I think literally everyone's back from the first movie reprising their roles. I don't know if there's someone I'm forgetting, but virtually everyone's back this time around. And doing a similar thing, got to go back to America, but for a different reason this time. Jericho, what do you think of the sequel?
Continuity, continuity, continuity. Mm-hmm. This movie has zero continuity. I was actually shocked at how truly fucking terrible this thing was. Like, my mouth was agape. I mean, I wasn't expecting anything groundbreaking. I wasn't even expecting anything that great here. But if you're going to all this effort, you're getting the gang back together, you're having Ruth fucking Carter do the costumes from Black Panther. Amazing. And here again,
the costumes do look great.
Costumes are like, it gets a bump on one star on Letterboxd, just at least a half star, just for Ruth Carter, because the costumes in this are beautiful, and they really make the scenery pop. But otherwise, this is like some embarrassing like Disney Channel family movie, right? I mean, this is like, we're talking about the first one being quaint and corny. I mean, it's not like the original was some hard-edged topical film with like a lot of stuff to say or was groundbreaking in its own right, you know, about class and the patriarchy or having a lot of things on its mind. But Craig Brewer here in the sequel, this is like bargain bin trash. I mean, I'm going to use the word hackneyed, limp, oof, unfunny, thin, labored, disjointed, and what other adjectives here. The plot, I mean,
turkey alert.
The plot's like a slight reversal on the first film's narrative. Akeem is now king, but he's got to go to America to find his illegitimate son to take the throne when he's gone, even though he has three capable badass daughters. And there's like a fight scene in the beginning. I guess what? That's going to come back, right? The setup for Akeem learning of his son is awkward. You know, really awkward. They clip in entire scenes from the first fucking movie here.
That was weird. They did that like three different times.
Not just, I mean, like short like scenes, like long scenes.
Like, well, from and this movie. It almost seems like.
What's and, can we talk like, about a certain like, technology? Yeah,
I have.
Oh yeah, de-aging.
Oh yeah, the de-aging Uncanny Valley mocap, whatever the hell.
I mean, it looks good. I think the de-aging looks, I mean, this might be my hottest take, but I think the de-aging's great. This is better than fucking Star Wars.
Even if it looks good, you know you're watching something that shouldn't be there. Like
there's this weird disconnect, but just on the technical level, I think they pretty much nailed it, to be honest. I'm not gonna be as effusive with this movie otherwise, but especially in a movie that, I mean, frankly, I don't want to step on your toes here, Jericho, but this movie's very ugly. So if the tech side of things actually works, I'm gonna give props where they're due, because I mean, you talk about Disney Channel movies. Jericho, I don't want to feed you your lines, but this movie was not made for streaming. So it's not the same thing as the Netflix sheen, but
it doesn't have that sheen. I'll give it that.
Oh, I was going to say it does look terrible. I was going to say this movie
doesn't look
looks
like Netflix sheen, though. It
Amazon
does look
analog.
It looks digital.
So what is it?
It's digital, just, and fake, but it doesn't have the bright Netflix filter. It's different. It's It's, I don't know if it's the Amazon analog or whatever I'm talking about, but it definitely looks like a TV series to me.
Yeah, totally.
Like, whereas the first one I was talking about, the cinematography, the grain of it shot on film, it looks good. This looks like it was shot digitally with green screens. And obviously you see in the first movie, yeah, they're, you know, James Earl Jones, Eddie Murphy, they're walking past fucking real like animals and stuff. Like there's like zebras and lions and stuff in that movie, just walking around in the background. And this, you have like a CGI lion who farts. I mean, that's the joke. Like, it's like, we're really going to do that here? I mean, you can't even afford to have like a one like live animal in a shot. So you're spending all this money on CGI. It's just, it's pretty baffling. I mean, what I was saying, get all these scenes from the first movie, like forced in. Leslie Jones shows up as like Murphy's one night stand. And at least she's trying to mug for laughs, even if like her presence here is mostly cosmetic. She's given very little to do, but she's like, she's trying. Yeah. I give her
credit. She works. She brought the energy. She's doing something.
They don't give her enough to do. Like they put her in scenes and it's like, hey, just go crazy. You know, say something that you think is funny. It feels like it feels improvised half the time. And like, she's not even in the same movie with these other actors. But the main thing is I feel the same way about Snipes, who seems to be, yes, having a blast.
Here we go.
As a rival general with a funny walk and this like weird voice. But, you know, I think this character should have been expanded. He seems to be onto something, but the script and then Brewer's like direction treats him as a piece of like revolving furniture. He just kind of comes in when the plot needs him and he goes away. And why not pit Snipes and Jones together? This is like a fatal flaw. You have Leslie Jones doing her thing. You have Snipes doing his thing. They never have a scene together. I mean, come on. Get the fuck out of here. Like, just rewrite on the script for sure. And if you care to admit that the original works, it does because there's an earnestness to it. Because it had like good energy. And the idea of these black characters having like upward mobility, like in this capitalist system, like all these characters come from wealth. They come from Africa. It's kind of cool to see them in that light, playing characters like that. But I think this movie has no patience. There's like a lot of ideas that are introduced and then like quickly they just throw them away. There's like scenes that start and then they cut away. There is no comedic momentum. This is kind of like what Chris was saying. Like in the first film, scenes were allowed to breathe. They kind of played out. There was that pacing to it. And it's not like this one is frenetic necessarily, but the actors never seem to be playing off one another. Like, are their scenes even shot together? It's like baffling. Like the continuity of where people are in the scenes and the shots, like, was this filmed somewhere else? And they just like,
yeah, like
in other
like
scenes?
The scene, for example, like when Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall, they kind of have this back and forth in James Earl Jones' bedroom, but it's like clearly they had James Earl Jones for like, what, an hour and a half?
Yeah.
They shot his scene and then he's gone. He's fucking out of there. And so then they shoot this other half of the scene with Murphy and Hall, and I forget who the other character who comes in. But you never get a wide shot that like shows them all together. It's just like, what, he just like cut? He's not even in this scene anymore. Like, what is happening?
Yeah, it's just terrible. It's a terrible script. It's terrible direction. And the whole movie is just self-contained moments. It's just self-contained scenes that may or may not work on their own, but there's no continuity. Like I said, there's no connection to what else is going on. You do have Jermaine Fowler here. He's the estranged son. He Eddie Murphy goes and gets him in America, goes back to Zamunda. He falls for like one of his maids instantly and wants to marry her, even though they have like three scenes together. This whole thing is laughable. And the winning chemistry between Murphy and Arsenio Hall is, I think, also missing in this one. Hall especially feels sidelined. Well, Murphy's just more worried about letting down his wife and his daughters. trying to groom his son. There's just so many embarrassing moments in this, guys. It's like a lot of just laziness, is repeating gags from the first movie, doing like a slight variation on those gags. I mean, we get to see the one-legged barking lady again, still doing that. I mean, that's fucking lazy and just lame. The high-pitched singer in Zamunda is back, doing, I think, which is the funniest moment from the original, but then here, it's not funny. And bringing in Vogue and Salt-N-Pepa for no reason is also not funny.
A lot of music in this. Lots of musical.
Just bring on these cameos that have no bearing to anything. The climax, though, almost got me back on board by just how like cartoonish and ridiculous it was. I mean, the badass daughter action scene versus Snipes is... Oh man, it's like the Princess Diaries meets like a thrift store Black Panther, and I did laugh. The only laugh in the movie, I didn't laugh once, but I laughed during this scene, but just because it was so corny and looked like such a children's movie that I just was like, I don't believe this. This is so bad that it's actually creeping towards being good and funny. Yeah, and I already mentioned the farting CG lion. We don't need to go into that whole thing where Jermaine Fowler has to get this lion's hair, this whole contraption he has to build. I mean, hopefully you guys had a little more fun with this than me, but it was never something that I was going to like just turn off and walk away from, because there's some kind of fascination with just how truly awful it was that kept me going, you know, just to see like... I mean, they had the elements in place, you know, and I don't know if a sequel to Coming to America could even work even with the best people involved. But even when they go back to America, they just go to one street on Queens and into the barber shop, and those guys are still there. There's like all this other stuff they can do in a modern New York. They don't do anything.
Everyone in that barbershop gets to live to be at least 100, yeah, by the way.
It's like 120 now, those guys. It's like,
unbelievable.
There's no like care taken to like what other things can we do with this. They just recycle the same fucking beats. They just have the inversion of the, you know, estranged son aspect. And it's just Jermaine Fowler's like, he seems like he's in a goofy sitcom like on NBC. I don't, fuck, man, this thing.
Oh,
this movie was real stinker.
I mean, I gotta tell you, I mean, this movie snuck up on me in a terrible way. 2021, not that many movies out yet. You know, it's a rough time. I do have two podcasts, so I'm keeping up. I've seen, you know, maybe 20 movies or so from this year already. But two movies in 2021 where I got to see Colin fucking Jost. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. How dare you? Two movies with Colin Jost. What the fuck did I do to deserve this?
Oh, well, Louis Anderson was back, and that was nice. I did enjoy seeing him. So they had, two white characters in this one?
Yeah, Jost and Anderson. Jesus Christ, Colin Jost. Anyway, yeah, this movie doesn't work, unfortunately. And it's really unfortunate. It has like major foundational, like the structure of this is so wrong. Like Jericho was saying, the pieces are there and they kind of are, but the story that they're telling is so flawed from the outset that it's shocking that this didn't get some kind of rewrite, and who knows how many rewrites it got over the last 30 years, but that this was the path that they finally went with. You have this story set up. So you have Murphy and Headley in Zamunda, and they're there, and you have his three daughters, and there's all these jokes about how he doesn't have a son. So, you know, from the first 4 minutes of this movie, you know, you can tell from multiple miles away what the lesson that Eddie Murphy's going to learn is, right? I mean, it's very, very clear what's being set up at the very beginning of this movie. Okay. So, you know, there's no spoilers here, but guess what? He's going to learn that it's okay to let women lead. That's going to be his big lesson in this. Got it. Cool. No problem. I don't have any problem with this. Technically on a conceptual level. What I do have a problem with, okay, that's the lesson we're going to get. This character is going to change. He had, you know, the way he saw, you know, women in the first movie, now 30 years later, how is that going to evolve for Akeem, for this character? Sure, no problem. But we're going to spend the majority of the movie with his son, this random dude, Jermaine Fowler, this character who, I mean, brings nothing to this story. It's just none of the energy of the first movie, no new energy. And I don't know who this guy is. Apparently, I've seen him in a couple of things. But, I mean, I could buy it if they got some, you know, some hot commodity for the son character in this, right? If you got something on your hands, you know, if you have like early Michael B. Jordan or something, right? Where it's just like, we got this guy. He's undeniable. He's great on screen. We got to give him as much screen time as possible. Okay, fine. Go ahead. But when you just have some random dude that's not bringing anything particularly funny, not particularly engaging, not compelling on the romantic side of things, this guy's not doing so much. Why does the movie revolve around him? Like, instead of Murphy and Arsenio Hall, we're following this guy for the majority of the movie. The movie is setting up the morals and the lesson to be about the daughters, but they're hardly in it. Like, they're completely in the background. The oldest daughter has a couple of scenes, I guess, none of them particularly good, but like, they're completely in the background, even though the obvious moral of the story is going to be Akeem learning to appreciate and respect his daughters more, but they're not even in the movie to actually be real characters that have any defining qualities or interests. Like, the exact things that Eddie Murphy was talking about in his character was talking about in the first movie, about like, oh, what are your interests? Like, what do you like? What do you want to do with it? Like he does that interview, right, with his arranged marriage, you know, bride to be, you know, ask the same questions of the daughters in this movie. Like, this movie does not give them a chance to have any of their own interests, their own desires, their own anything. They're just background, like, set dressing. Huge problem. Why this movie focuses on the son character, that is a huge problem in the movie. I get what, you know, I get how it works for the plot, but to have so much of the runtime dedicated to him, that's a massive foundational problem with this movie. The other thing that, you know, I hammered the point home so hard in the previous discussion was all of that energy, all of that charm that Eddie Murphy brought to even little scenes. Like, I talk about him talking about football with the McDowell's manager, and he just has this energy and this, you know, this charisma, this cornball fun energy to it. Even if it's not particularly funny, like, there's something really watchable and engaging about that character. What the hell? Like, it's gone. It is sapped out of this character. Like, he's not smiling. He's not having fun. He's not doing any. It's just, he's so subdued for the whole movie. It is some of the lowest energy Eddie Murphy that I've ever seen. I mean, this is like him doing a drama in what's supposed to be like a big, broad comedy sequel. But there's just there's nothing there with this character anymore. Like, they completely robbed him of all the joy from the first movie. Even when he goes back to America, goes back to Queens, he's not like having fun and, you know, seeing the sights, or, you know, there's none of that awe to that character. He seems just completely like beaten down. He's just an old man who doesn't have any joy in his life. And it's sad. It's sad to see what's been done to this character, to be honest. And with that low energy, where are the jokes, guys? Where, I mean, Jericho said that he didn't find the first one particularly funny. I mean, I name checked a few jokes. There wasn't even really jokes in this movie. Like, there's just a lot of scenes that I don't, you know, he puts on the same New York Mets jacket. Is that the joke? That's the joke. Like, what where's even like the setups, the payoff? You know, I don't know. It's just not a lot there on the table. And then, you know, I mean, the movie's doing this whole thing about him respecting his daughters, letting them, you know, rule the country, all that stuff. Sure. But, you know, not to be the PC police here, guys, but, you know, a big plot point of this movie, like, drugging and raping a character and having that be like a pivotal plot point to what sets off the whole movie. I don't know. For a broad comedy, really? I don't know. It just doesn't work. That doesn't work for me. That rubbed me the wrong way as well. So there's some things here and there. I think Leslie Jones isn't given a lot to do, but she mostly works in this. This is going to be my passing the baton, but I mean, out of everything in this movie, everything that they're bringing to the table, I want to see the movie that Wesley Snipes is in. Armando, I'm passing it to you now, right? I mean, that Wesley Snipes movie, whatever he's doing, give me more of that, right? His hairstyle, his costuming, his energy. Armando, he's from the neighboring country to Zamunda, Nextdoria. Come on, Nextdoria? The dictator ladies, general, yeah. Is he from Nextdoria? But that's like some cornball, goofy, like there's something there, I think, in that part of the movie. But, you know, we don't really get much of that. But you wanted to see more Snipes, right? You were begging for more Snipes?
I don't know if begging, but like you guys said, there's something, it's a bit wasted. It's a bit undercooked. It was almost, and I think laziness is a term. I mean, you know, the Nextdoria thing, even though maybe that's kind of funny in a way, but it kind of is a microcosm of the laziness within this film. And yeah, there's, I think that, you know, just quick on the Snipes thing, Craig Brewer, you know, he's in a couple films. I don't think any films that anybody here is really crazy about, but, and you know, like I think he's done Black Snake Moan, like Hustle and Flow. He did Dolomite, which I was pretty mixed on, and Snipes was in that, and Snipes was having an absolute blast. And it's kind of, you know, carrying over this bit of, you know, Eddie Murphy is back thing, where he didn't do films for a while. You know, I didn't listen to the podcast, but I guess he was on Marc Maron and admitting, yeah, I did a bunch of shitty, terrible movies. I took some time off. I think there's even mentioned how he got a Raspberry Award for like worst actor ever, and that really actually got to him. And so, you know, and he kind of came back, did like, you know, he had the Dreamgirls kind of small role. You know, and he's kind of bagging things. There was talk of him coming back doing stand-up again, which was derailed obviously by the pandemic. And so yeah, so he's back in the swing of things, making films. And I think with Dolomite, which some people were pretty stoked about, which I felt was you know, I was very mixed on, it did feel like it's, and that's the kind of the thing with a lot of the, you know streaming service movies, where it's just it's cash. You can really churn these things out, get the stars on board. And I think that was kind of what Dolomite was, you know, let's get all these actors together, we have this concept, we can get it together pretty quickly. And but the movie underneath it is pretty flimsy and thin, and you know, flimsiness can be fun, but here it's not. And it's, you know, these kind of these retreads are, you know, they're pretty popular, pretty easy to do. And it is going to rely, you know, on a lot of fan favor and fan service. And that's okay to a degree. But, you know, if 90% of the jokes are, hey, we're pretty much replaying the exact same scene from the first movie. Hey, remember when we did this 30 years ago? Hey, remember this character? And some of that's going to be fun. And some of that, you know, it's in the recipe book. It's fine. It's okay. This was just so overwhelmingly that it became kind of tiring. And like, where's the movie? And this, you know, we don't expect this to be, you know, screenwriting, a masterclass of these kind of films. But, you know, it's nice if there's a little more effort taken. And this, I keep coming back to the term lazy, and it's a mess. It's definitely not a beautiful, adventurous, risk-taking mess. And they're trying to juggle a bunch of things, and it's just, everything is just spread so thin that most of it falls flat. I definitely didn't loathe it as much as as Jericho did. I might have laughed a few times, not heartily, but yeah, you know, we talk about.
Does one come to mind? I don't mean to put you on the spot. Yeah, but like, no, that's it's funny. Like I can't remember a lot of jokes, like actual like setups and jokes, like. You know, like I'm not trying to be a dick, but like, do you remember like something that would have made you laugh?
I can't really. I was as you guys were talking, I was trying to like pull something specific, and I couldn't really. I couldn't. I think Leslie Jones is trying. I think I enjoyed a couple of Tracy Morgan moments, but I can't really remember. I can't nothing that I could quote. And he's kind of just doing his thing, being Tracy Morgan. I maybe thought a couple of those things was funny. I actually liked. You know, and you go easy on me here because this is going somewhere. I did like Jermaine Fowler just as a screen presence. I'd seen him before. I know he's a stand-up. I didn't know where I remembered him from. He looks familiar. I guess he was the show I'd seen Crashing about stand-up comics. He just had a small role in there. I think he's actually decent. He's okay. He has something, but he's not giving much. It's very interesting. It's this thing. He's kind of like he's gonna do. You know, he didn't have a father growing up. He's kind of doing his own. He wants to, you know, make it his own way. So there's a couple of side gags with this, you know, with this walk, you know, he finds a way to outsmart the lion. And, you know
what that all that reminded me is like a Salvation Army version of Will Smith in The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Okay.
It's like that kind of character who thinks he's tough, but is actually just a goober. But doesn't have the charm or like the charisma of old Will Smith from that TV series. That's kind of like the thing. He's just kind of walking around wide eyed, and there's no characterization to that guy. You pick him up out of Queens.
He's not on the level of an early Will Smith. I mean, but I kind of like Jermaine Fowler okay enough, and you know, I'm definitely not, as Christian said, the PC place like. You know, this movie should have been about this, or it should have. I'm okay with the movie being taking its own turn, you know, being ruled by its own terms as long as it's done well. So I'm not one to say this should have been about this character. But in this case, when you are, you know, kind of weaving in these, you know, and they are kind of, but at this point, pretty basic. You know, feminine, and I think in a way it does kind of work because there are some jokes about like, seriously, I have to explain this to this male that this is not how it works, like in it being that obvious, and that you know, them being this prehistoric in their way of thinking, something that's slightly funny and that they're aware of, you know, just how primitive some of this thinking is, but you know, if you're gonna do that, then. You know, we have, it's her name is, she was in If Beale Street Could Talk, Kiki Lane, right?
Yeah. The oldest daughter. Yeah.
Yeah. And then when you forget she's even in the movie for a large chunk, she's like, oh yeah, she's the eldest daughter. She's invested in this. Right. And that's supposed to pay off late in the film. And Eddie Murphy does have some acting chops. And we know Kiki Lane definitely does. So it's fine if you want to make the story about Jermaine Fowler, but you have this big message and you're supposed to have this investment in this. And by the time they have, you know, the payoff, you don't feel anything at all. There's just,
right.
You know, she has a scene with Fowler where they're bonding. I guess that's kind of okay, but there's hardly anything except for a couple of, you know, tense conversations between her and Murphy, you know, and I think that just goes to spreading things thin. I mean, you have, and also Arsenio Hall, who is his chemistry with A. Murphy in the first film, everything just gets just short shrift because, you know, he's kind of useless here, right? Like he was, you know, essentially, you know, his traveling partner in the first film. And here there's not much for him to do, right? He's just kind of there like, hey, protect the kingdom while I'm away or whatever. And so he's pretty sidelined. The wife at this point is, you know, she's kind of taking the place of the queen from the first movie, you know, there's not much there. And Murphy, I don't want to go as far as to bring in one of my other quotes. He's checked out here, but he himself, you know, the thing with Dolemite is, oh, Murphy's having a blast. He's re-engaged, you know. Here, even he doesn't seem engaged with the material. He seems kind of bored with the entire proceedings, which is somewhat, you know, cooked into the character. And, you know, there's some kind of things that could have been interesting here with, you know, he's forgetting, you know, the man he used to be. He's turning into his father. I mean, some of that rings kind of true.
No, no, it's just so awkward, though. It's like,
but it's lame, but it's handled lame. Yeah.
There's these early scenes where he's like, how he talks to and about his daughters is very kind of civilized and modern. And it seems like he kind of understands the thing. But then he has these scenes where he like talks down to his wife, like, just do as you're told, or, you know, some really like hacky dialogue. It's like this, you know, sitcom Disney Channel stuff where it's like, where did this come from? You're like, all of a sudden this character just turns into like a you know, obvious misogynist for like 6 seconds, and then he's just checked out, and then the rest of the time he's woke. Like, what the hell? Like, what is this character?
It is a bummer because it's not, you know, like, he's obviously, that's Eddie Murphy in the first film, but also it's like Akeem is this wholesome, likable character I can separate a little bit from Eddie Murphy, and here it's just really, it's just kind of a bummer, you know, like how he's there's just zero energy emanating from this character. It's just it's almost like just a buzzkill anytime he's on screen, which is weird. Which is weird when it's Eddie Murphy, even if he's you know playing it down a little bit, playing it straight a little bit. And so, yeah, then it just becomes a cavalcade of as many cameos and callbacks as possible to the first film.
A cavalcade of callbacks.
Yeah,
that's good. That's nice. I like that.
I mean, yeah, and it's like it's just unforgivable that for long stretches, like, where's Kiki Layne? She's gonna be the queen, right? Okay, right. What happened to her? Like, I mean,
also. Let's put an end to this commercialized feminism thing where it's like, oh, they're strong female characters because they can kick ass and they have no other like investment in these characters as people. It's like, that's lazy, you know? And
right. Yeah. I mean,
trying to be progressive, but it's like, it's actually more damaging, I think, because they don't give those characters anything to do in the movie other than fight. It's like,
right. Yeah, it's like, they're... follow your own logic. Like, if that's going to be the payoff to your movie is, you know, the women are allowed to lead the country and Akeem has his change of heart. Great. Then make that what the movie is about. Like, the movie's not about that. It's a clear setup. And then it disappears. That plot disappears from the story until the last 10 minutes. It's so stupid. It is really aggravating that's the case. Honestly,
I'm okay with... Oh, no, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Miranda.
Yeah, no, I'm okay with some of, you know, some humor being in quote unquote poor taste, but I mean, it's just super lame. The whole, you know, unknown pregnancy, that the way that was played with the terrible, I thought it was, to me it was Uncanny Valley, and it was I thought it was pretty bad. I'm like, this is not even. You know, it can be ridiculous, it can be silly, like, I can't believe they're doing this, but it was just like a lame way to shoehorn in this lady. They couldn't have thought of something else. I mean, that stuff was just bad.
Nightclub stuff?
The nightclub stuff.
But also, like, Leslie Jones was the same age, like, that was 30 years ago. Like, she looks strange. The same.
Yeah. And then...
Quick to jump in there.
Yeah.
Like this drugged, like, rape, the vibes on that scene are just so weird to me. Like that plot point. And it's also like even more offensive because it retcons the original movie. And like, you know, Armando and I were higher on that. And we kept saying over and over, it's the, the wholesomeness, like the feelings right. of the movie. And so now the original is tainted because in the middle of their adventure in the first movie, Arsenio Hall and like went on this like drug, like sex, you know, rampage. Like what? Like that does not track with the other movie. I just fucking yeah. watched that movie. That well, does not make any sense with that character.
With Arsenio Hall in the first one, he was trying to get laid like a lot.
Yeah, but yeah, but there's a tone in this movie that doesn't match. I don't think. I think it's a weird mismatch. Yeah. I
mean, well, they're trying to play it both ways. They're trying to say like, oh, this thing happened, but he wasn't really aware of it, or he's not responsible. It's like because he was, you know, blowing cannabis in someone's face is going to make them pass out. I mean, like the whole thing is weird. Just, like, but it would have been braver if they're going to go that route. To just have it be like a consensual thing. Like he just gets laid that night. It's one night stand and he felt bad about it, but it happened. You know, you could have done it. I think that would have been better if you're going to do it at all, which I think it's probably a stupid idea.
Honestly,
to do it.
Like they're going to have the daughters, you know, taking the throne. Obviously that's the payoff. They probably had that idea, like the first idea for this movie. If you're going to copy so much of the formula of the first movie, just do the same thing. Have Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall take Kiki Lane to Queens, and she's trying to find a husband because she has to marry a good husband. She's not going to marry Wesley Snipes' son or whatever. Like, she's going to find her own partner and have that set up. And if you're going to copy the movie so much, do that. Why make this weird, like, de-aging, CG, like, drug sex thing, like, weasel that into the first movie? It's a just such a poorly executed idea. It's a bad idea that's even furtherly poorly executed.
Or you could have the daughter, the Kiki Lane character, get so upset that she can't take the throne and just be done with Zamunda, and she takes off and she goes to New York and she's living her life like early 20s in New York. She's got a boyfriend or a girlfriend, you flip it, whatever. And then him and Arsenio Hall go to try to get her back.
Gotta find her. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, something. I mean, there's all kinds of things you could do that would be better, because then Kiki Lane would have her own character, independent character in New York.
Absolutely.
And she doesn't want to go back. And it's just to create this whole scenario with this birth of the son, and it's just so convoluted. Like,
well, and also how much time has passed. It feels kind of weird for that character to be like 31. It feels like he should be like 20 or something, you know, like for that guy to just have nothing going on. I don't know. It doesn't feel right. I mean, the Leslie Jones thing, she looks exactly the same 30 years. It just all feels off. And to be honest, I watched this movie immediately before we recorded. I had about 20 minutes from credits to when we started recording. So very fresh in my mind. But I got to say, I was so bored. I don't think I hated this as much as Jericho did. But once we got to the point where it's like, okay, fucking Jermaine Fowler's character is going to have a wedding, and then, all right, Eddie Murphy's going to have his change of heart. Okay, yeah, Kiki Ling going to be on the throne, blah, blah, blah. I am so checked out. I don't even remember it, and I just watched it. Like, it felt so paint by numbers to me that I could not care less than I did. And then I was brought back, not in a positive way, but like jolted back to life by maybe the worst thing in the movie outside of the rapey thing that I wasn't a fan of, but maybe the worst sequence in the movie, this We Are Family dance to close the film. We Are Family, I Got Sexual Chocolate With Me. That's what they're singing. And pain. Just that is so bad. I can't even process how bad of an ending that is.
And just to wrap up for me, there was a couple mild laughs. I liked Louis Anderson in the garb. I did kind of like, those are the kind of moment that the whole scene is kind of corny, but when he talks with John Amos, or just the moment when he talks about, you know, when I used to mop this floor, you know, there's something I liked about that. That was kind of okay. You know, also the directing too, which kind of went into the TV feel of this, where, I don't know, maybe there's something to where Akeem is not as into the pomp and circumstance that his father is, but everything is just so scaled down. It feels like a TV show, the grandiosity of Zamunda is gone, right? Everything is smaller scale, and it doesn't feel like a choice within the story. It just feels like a budgetary thing. I liked Louis Anderson in the garb. I think I might have already said that. And I did like before it completely derailed. I think I liked the initial moments of Sexual Chocolate. Just the vocal delivery was kind of funny. But that's pretty much it.
If you guys stay through the credits, John Legend, clearly in his house, this has got to be a post-COVID edition. Over the credits, John Legend is performing the She's Your Queen to Be song in his own falsetto. Yeah, no, that didn't.
I didn't even see how you. I turned off. Like, once I started seeing there's bloopers, I fucking just. There's no way. Like, they're laughing at stuff that's not like jokes that were not even in the movie. It was just like, what is this shit? You know?
Yeah, it's a bummer. It's a bummer.
Especially when like the whole movie feels like that. It feels like a demo reel of like stuff from the first movie. Like, why are you gonna watch deleted scenes or scenes that were cut out?
Oh man. It's a bummer. It's too bad. It's too bad. All right, let's get out of here and let's bring back. It's been a minute, guys. We haven't all three of us been here for a while. Before this, we did Best of the Year. Before that, you know, we did Cram Session. We did a New to Me episode. It's time to get back to Rogue, guys. Nick Rogue. We're in an autography series. Only two films left and just this massive hiatus. So now it is time, without further ado. We're talking about Two Deaths from 1995, starring Sonia Braga, Patrick Malahide, and Ian Karamitru. The synopsis, a tale of power, passion, and obsession set in a politically torn Eastern European country. Not a lot there to that synopsis, I gotta say. That's it. That's all we get. Armando, when did you watch this?
Yeah, not a lot of meat on that bone. Let's see. I would say, I think we were in lockstep as you were watching Coming to America. I was watching Two Deaths, so
you watched this today. Okay,
we were in very different headspaces.
Jer, when did you watch this?
Whenever it was first proposed, okay. As the pairing or as the next autobiography, I think I watched it within a week of that. So I don't remember the timeline, but it was it even before February?
I watched this, I think, January. February 1st, and I think you watched it before I did. So
late January.
I intentionally have Armando leading us off here. You know, I haven't forgotten this movie, but it's definitely not fresh for me anymore. So Armando, you need to do some heavy lifting for us. Yeah, I mean, not the plot breakdown. I mean, who cares? But, you know, set the stage. What are we working with for Two Deaths, and what did you think?
Well, on that note, I would love it if anybody wanted to chime in at any point with some context for the Romanian Revolution, if you'd like to, you know, some things that went over my head.
No problem. I'm all over that.
The psyche of Romania at that time, with the bloodshed going on around them. I mean, does Rogue even care about that? Is that, you know, how big does that factor in here? But I haven't gone over the filmography, but I don't know. I know where we left off. I wasn't in the highest of favor with Rogue. I mean, I think it's been a streak of I either thought they were close to terrible or didn't quite get there. So, when I looked at a review, I know this is a one star for Ebert. I don't know if you've looked at his review, and I think he lost interest. If you go back and read his review, I think he lost interest while he was writing the review. didn't really give much effort into it, into really deciphering this one. But Rogue is as weird as ever. What is he on about? What is inspiring him? It's yet another strange brew of elements. And I kind of liked this one. I know it's been a while. It's been a few films, and you know, I don't think this is really necessarily psychologically, intellectually profound, or deep. I think it's kind of funny in a way. You see these men. There's this dinner party, hosted by, you know, it's Michael Gambon, who this is like a guy I feel like I've seen in a million films, but I was trying to think, you know, what have I actually seen this guy? And, you know, I guess he's huge as, you know, he's in these Harry Potter movies, right?
Which Dumbledore, man.
Right, right. So I know I knew this guy, but never quite. Right.
What's that? I was just sad, like this, like, well-respected thespian, that's what he's known for.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Dumbledore.
He's Dumbledore. I mean, come on. I mean, that's what, if you know, people recognize Michael Gambon, it's definitely as Dumbledore, right? I mean, these billion-dollar movies, he's in six of them or whatever. Like, yeah, I mean, it's definitely what he's known for.
Yeah, I guess he's in Clean Slate. I guess he's in Clean Slate with Dana Carvey, too.
Oh, there you go. Crossover.
I guess he's in Life Aquatic. He's got a small role in that.
He's in a lot of movies.
Yeah, he's a legend of the stage. But this is, I don't know, maybe the first one I've seen him in where he is kind of a lead role. I mean, it's an ensemble, but you know, he's essentially kind of the lead character. He's kind of leading most of the action. You have this dinner party with, you know, it's kind of unclear to me exactly. I guess they're friends. And he kind of unfurls this. It kind of starts out like, am I watching some kind of you know, murder mystery here at this dinner party? And then it unfolds in this bizarre way where, you know, we kind of get the backstory on, we see this photo of this beautiful woman, and they're trying to figure out the story. And then I believe the Daniel Pavinic, played by Gambon, he sits down with them and he tells them kind of the whole story about the maid and his obsession, and through that their individual stories unfold. And this is just basically about sexually obsessed pathetic men and the lengths that they go to. And you know, I think the performance is pretty good. I mean, Gambon, he's another unhinged rogue lead performance. I mean, are there some problematic elements here? I mean, this guy, he's humiliating Sonia Braga here, who is not given much to do. I mean, and that's by design. I mean, he's grabbing her, he's humping her, he's throwing her brassiere at people. I mean, Gambon is completely unhinged. I mean, if you know this guy,
horn dogging it.
Yeah, yeah, major. I wrote that down earlier. I set that aside, but major horn dogging here. He's completely unhinged. I mean, if you know this guy as a Harry Potter character, it's gonna be ruined by some of the things this guy's up to.
Cancel Dumbledore.
Canceled. Yeah, there's some out there rogue stuff here where, you know, I don't know how much this these disparate, you know, influences with the, you know, the outside world burning around them in this revolution to me felt kind of clunky. You know, does it really add much of a context? Was it necessary? I mean is the subtext there with, you know, the temperature of the country and what it's doing to these men? Is there something there? I don't know. I didn't necessarily feel it. I mean, maybe there's a joke in there as all these things are going on around them, they are consumed, by their obsession and undone by their obsessions. Maybe there's some humor in that. That stuff didn't really, it didn't derail anything for me. Overall, I thought this was weirdly humorous. I mean, and not, I wasn't guffawing or laughing out loud or anything, or, you know, thrashing about my knees and thighs. But you know, there was just some laughs in the performances and some of the dialogue, just, you know, these men's explanations for their, you know, their perversions, their fears or regrets, the men behaving badly and pathetically. I just found kind of humorous in presented in a way that, you know, is very, very Rogan, with these where it's just those elements where you don't know if he's in on the joke. Does he know that some of this stuff seems bad? Is the fact that some of it plays pretty badly, is he aware of that? Like, you know, I mean, some of this the backstory with the guy, you know, with his younger with his younger self, you know, chasing after a younger Anna. I mean, some of this stuff is like, it's like really ridiculous, right? He's got this mustache. he talks a lot. I mean, and I think he does a good job of mimicking the voice, you know, of the older Daniel. I mean, this actor, he's got this mustache. He's, you know, he's running people off the road. You know, the stuff starting to come back.
It's starting to come back.
Yeah. You know, his romantic competitor that he must vanquish, how that's all handled. You know, are they riding horses at some point? I don't even remember. Is there a Tarkovsky reference in here? I mean, just all these things that Rogue throws into this pot, and some of it seems kind of bad, and there's no exact rhyme or reason for why does it work in this film and not this other one, which I thought was borderline terrible. I don't know if I can completely explain why. It's just some of this stuff made me laugh for the, you know, just the level of revulsion you have for some of these characters. And then, I mean, you know, why, you know, I guess, I don't know if I think this is based on a book or something, a novel. I didn't really dig into that. You know, maybe, you know, how much did he, you know, trim this down to suit like his own methods? What did he distill from it? I don't know. I mean, the horn dog and the perverseness of Rogue's nerve kind of worked for me. I mean, it's definitely not top tier Rogue or anything. I'm not sure I will ever rewatch it, but I kind of mildly enjoyed it for all those kind of you know, Rogue-isms of him just throwing a bunch of stuff in the pot. You don't know how much of it's intentional or unintentional. And it just kind of worked. I mean, I will remember this one as some of the other Rogue films, you know, have kind of, you know, during the fallow period have kind of evaporated a little bit for me. So I have no idea where you guys are going to go on this one, as I think is being, you know, the trend for me recently with later period Rogue.
I mean, given some of the things that Jericho has defended, there's no chance that he's out on this one. No chance.
That's fair to say.
You know, you may have forgotten some of it, but I am, you know what? I'm putting in the bank. I'm calling up Vegas. I'm putting down a big bet on.
You're guaranteeing? Are you guaranteeing?
I'm going to guarantee it.
What's the spread here? I mean, are you saying this is a 4-star, 4.5?
Is this no? I'm saying positive.
That's not much of a bet at this point.
Are we going minimum 3 out of 4 here?
Have I disliked any? I mean, I don't think
yeah,
so.
3 out of 4. Yeah, I would put my hard earned, cold hard cash, double hard, cash down on at least a 3-star rating from Jericho for
all right.
Nikki Rogue's two deaths. Jericho, what'd you think?
Yeah. Well, I do admit here that as Armando was talking, certain images, the flashback stuff I had forgotten about, and then his recollections definitely got me giggling because I started remembering the prowling, the mustache, the weird voices. So a lot of that maybe bumps this up even more, but because I had forgotten. But so the mind's a little fuzzy here. memories have sort of faded. You know, what, like 2 months ago I watched this thing. However, I do remember mostly liking it. So yeah, okay, Christian, you win that round. This isn't in the category of Eureka or Castaway. This is not a rave session here where I'm going to expound upon. But it's got enough Rogue in there, the stuff I like from Rogue. Actually, it's a good and bad thing, this movie, in that it surprised me. And this is something I keep saying with each Rogue movie after I think I've seen it all. I always say, like, he surprises me in some way. And I think the politically minded, less obtuse angle that this film takes, as opposed to some of his other ones that are just like almost incomprehensible from a story standpoint, that surprised me. There's still weirdness. There's still some like satire here, but also very specific points about like exercising power, like how to become so obsessive, how to satisfy that obsessive desire in a way that's unbecoming or borderline evil. The bad part of this is that you don't quite get as many of the goofy faces or the bizarro tangents, aside from the flashback stuff. You don't get quite as much of that, like, just way out there rogueisms in this film. And that's okay. It's kind of, in a way, more of a straightforward movie about public and private behavior. Especially in terms of violence and sex. Maybe that's why Armando maybe grasped onto this one a little bit more, because it is a little bit more streamlined for a Rogue movie. I'll say that. It's still weird and doing strange things, but you can understand these conversations. You can follow the logic of what's going on. And it's basically like a chamber play taking place mostly in this lavish dinner party in Romania. And then outside, there's this violent revolution on the streets. So you get the politically connected rich surgeon who's played by Michael Gambon, of course, as Armando said. And then three old friends gather with him for their annual reunion, and they talk philosophy, medicine, education, women, sex, and then there's gunfire raging outside all around. So, you know, the irony there is not lost on anyone. There's almost a Boonwellian thing going on here, where occasionally members of the party like go downstairs to attend to like wounded police officers and soldiers, only to return to the party like as if nothing terrible and awful is actually happening outside. They just go about their business. And soon the conversations switch to mostly focus on sexual power dynamics, betrayal, obsession. And there's Armando had mentioned the Sonia Braga character. So there's like a mystery element involving this young woman's picture that's on the mantelpiece. And you find out that it's actually the younger, you know, a younger version of his current housekeeper, played by Braga. And these like Gambon's pathetic confessions about her coming spilling out. And if this came out today, this dude would immediately be pulled over by the problematic police and swiftly canceled. And but like, as this sad man unable to obtain this love from this woman, he admits to possessing her body, but not her love. So there's this real twisted, fucked up thing going on here. And the script here is by Alan Scott. It's very wordy, like a play. It's very wry, had some humor to it. Not every conversation or like non sequitur works. There's a link between Gambon's obsessions and his other two colleagues' problems with women. One of the guys like likes to be physically humiliated by prostitutes. Another pretends like his wife is dead because she cheated on him on a one-night stand. So he's got all these fucked up ideas about how to deal with that. So like a lot of diluted male psychology, particularly when it comes to like sexual hangups and dysfunction. I think Rogue is in on this, and he understands it, and he gets the joke of it, and it's like funneling into that and kind of exposing these guys as truly pathetic, sad, awful men, which I said many times in Rogue discussions that he does that a lot. I don't know if he, as Armando says, knows what's problematic or bad or what should be shown in a movie, but I don't think he's like a censorship guy. So I think he's going to put in whatever he feels is necessary for the story, and he doesn't really care about censoring it or making apologies. So on that level, I think he's aware. And if it seems bad from a social standpoint, he's still going to fucking put it in his movie. So mileage may vary there. I do think this movie lacks like the weirdo humor, the goofiness of some of the films from Rogue that I like the most, but it's a more metaphorical film than a literal one. It's more mean-spirited, I think. Very dark, very mean-spirited. It's less farcical or satirical as you might expect. But I think there is some moral complexity here because of Gambon's performance. I think this performance, the way he plays this guy, really works on more than one level. I think we know he's a monster, but is he the tormentor and the victim? It kind of plays your sympathies here. He's sinister, but also his performance at times is very calm, very serene. So he kind of gets you leaning forward, wanting to know more, just kind of like going back and forth on how awful this guy is. And I think that's a plus. And that's maybe not something we've seen in the last couple Rogue films, like a richness of a character who has some moral complexities. That's not usually the case. It's usually very broad with Rogue stuff, as of late, at least. So yeah, two deaths. I did like it. Some of the memories are flooding back. Some of the scenes are coming back to me. It is something that I would hope would find some kind of restoration at some point, because the video link was very poor quality. Mm. And a lot of these older Rogue films just had no sort of appreciation or no plans to be restored. I mean, so, like, what was it? Castaway is like shitty, like, oof, YouTube quality. I mean, these movies, this is a major director. I mean, I know these movies aren't well beloved, but you know, there's Arrow Films, one of these, you know, Kino, one of guys jump on this and just at least get some better transfers out and like a box set of Nicholas Rogue's, because I mean, it's still part of his body of work. And if you have to watch a screener link on some shitty website with ads going off everywhere, it looks probably worse than VHS. It's like a VHS has been gnarled definitely by a dog, you know, just chewed up a bit and spit, put back in the machine then. But even in that condition, I still, you know, I was still able to follow it and get a lot out of it. It's just, I'm hungry for some Rogue justice here on some of his more maligned work. But yeah, so Christian, yeah, sure. This is a solid 3.5 out of 5 or a 3 out of 4.
Hell yeah.
Good, not great Rogue film. So
hell yeah. You know what that is, folks? That's easy money. Easy money. Put it in the bank. Count it. Let it ride, baby. I don't know where I'm going with that.
We have to do some, like, I mean, the real thing here is gambling on you guys. It's you can make money on me all day, you know, unless I want to sort of subvert expectations on purpose to throw a wrench in it, which I will not do because I feel like I have some integrity.
Gotta play it straight.
But with you, it's usually an easy bet to guess you will not like a Rogue film, with some exceptions. Armando also is kind of going back and forth, it's difficult. I would almost say this one maybe you liked a little more than the ones that you really hated in the past. But I feel like it's a little more here for you, maybe. But
so you're saying it's a little bit higher, but I'm still out? Is that your
I'm
bet?
I'm thinking a 3 out of 5 on this one.
Okay. All right. I'm not quite there yet. I'm workshopping a character for the podcast where I'm betting only on the safe Jericho takes. So I'm going to workshop that a little bit. I don't have a name for the character, but, you know, like a big sports betting guy who's really overenthusiastic about all his bets, but only on the easy Jericho takes.
I guess it is a good sign. Like, you guys know my taste well enough at this point for how long I've been on here and writing reviews. You kind of know. Even Armando messaged me right when the review of Malcolm and Marie went up, he's like, I know that Jericho's going to pan this. Like, is this going to be a turkey? Even before, like, he talked to me about it. It's just, yeah. And I knew, based on the trailer, that I would not like it. It's like, am I this exposed?
No. You'll sometimes, you know, zig and zag a little bit, but I also want to add that I think this might have had a half star bump for me for not casting Teresa Russell in the Sonya Braga role. I don't know if, you know, they'd parted ways at this point, so you didn't even have a choice. But
I don't think there is any more.
Not that Russell doesn't have talent, but I mean, I might not have been able to take it if that had happened. So.
Might not have been able to take it. Oh man. All right. You guys, you know, I feel like I've been I've been like rope-a-doped here a little bit, just because I've been so out on Rogue over the last few movies. For the most part, I kind of liked what was the fucking Gary Oldman one. That one was
Track 29,
kind of bonkers and worked. But yeah, Castaway, I think Cold Heaven was the last one, right? That was real bad. Some of these ones, and the feeling, the pervading feeling that I feel coming out of these movie watching experiences is that Rogue just couldn't give less of a shit. Like, he is just so checked out. And it's even more frustrating because it's not checked out on some like paycheck movie. It's not like his direct-to-video stuff following this where he's checked out and he's doing The Adventures of Young Indiana Jones. Like, okay, yeah, I get that. You're checked out. You're doing some cash-in thing. But if you're checked out and you're doing these movies that have no commercial appeal, that aren't going to be successful, I'm sure he's not, you know, I'm sure he's not making a lot of money making something like Castaway, right? Like, that's not a financial proposition for him. It's just been really frustrating. It's been really frustrating to see where he came from, even in the 80s with things like Eureka, which, you know, well documented, I had a lot of problems with, but you could tell that he was invested and he was doing stuff in that movie for sure. And it was just really frustrating to see a lot of the intent seemingly gone, a lot of the purpose seemingly absent from his work for quite a while, at least in my estimation. So I'm back in. I'm rope-a-dope. This is where I'm circling back around. I feel like I'm rope-a-dope just because I was so used to that from him for a while. And this one, it just feels like he gives a shit. And maybe he didn't. I don't know. I mean, I can't know his intent on any of these movies. Maybe he didn't give a shit while making Performance, and that just became a fantastic movie by accident. I don't fucking know. But this seems like he's actually trying to do something here. With this movie, I know Armando said it's based on a book. I don't know anything about a novel. I mean, this movie, the source material, all of it's very obscure. There's not a lot of writing about any of this, so it's hard to read up or be learned about this at all. There's a total of 5 reviews for this movie on Letterboxd, mine being one of those 5. So not a lot of discourse in the year of our Lord 2021 on Nick Rogue's The Two Deaths. Actually, Armando, I know you're not on that. Do you want to know my Letterboxd review?
You want me to guess the star rating?
No. I want to know if you want to hear the review.
Yeah, is this a classic one liner?
it's like a run on sentence, but technically a one liner. Yes.
Yeah. Let's hear it.
You ever simp so hard you force a woman into lifelong servitude while agreeing to provide her real lover ongoing medical care and then seemingly brag about it at a stuffy dinner party in the middle of a revolution?
Who hasn't, right? Yeah, I think I wrote simp, but I didn't get it in one of my notes. I didn't use it, but so
I totally forgot about the other guy in the basement or whatever.
Yeah, he's like being nursed there. Like, he's there the whole for years. What a weird dynamic. Anyway, I was going to Armando brought up the novel that this is based on. It really feels like a play. I think Jericho mentioned that at one time, the setup here of all these, you know, stuffy guys in this, you know, eating all this fancy food. They keep changing the type of alcohol they're drinking. They're drinking from different kinds of glasses. They're getting a little bit more sloppy as the night goes on, but you could hear and even kind of feel this chaos going on outside really felt like a play conceit of, you know, of like these men kind of, you know, bragging at times or telling their stories, really being self-involved while something of major import is going on just literally outside their walls. And, you know, the movie version of this, I think, handles that well, as well, when it comes to that kind of bursting in, like literally a character, like bloodied character, like barges into their scene, into, you know, their setting at one point, that changes the dynamic of what's going on. But just the feeling of this, was something that I really felt like, I don't really know what it is. Like, I don't have a interpretation of everything going on in this movie, but it feels like there is a reason behind it, which has been absent for me for a few of the recent Rogues. And I also feel like, you know, this movie, there's Horn Dog in this movie's certainly salacious, and you know, that's something that is commonplace. It's in basically all of Rogue's movies except The Witches, I think, that, you know, to some degree. But I appreciate it more when I can sense some type of point of view on those characters. I mean, I don't know. And again, I don't have a grand interpretation or anything, but it feels like the point of view, the perspective on these characters is kind of taking the piss out of them. Like it's mocking them. It's highlighting the gross, the power dynamic that, you know, especially the lead character, but the men in this movie use to kind of take over and demand attention in the situation. I mean, even in the review that I wrote, it's not just him and his obsession with this woman, but he can only possess her to a certain degree, which kind of drives him insane. It drives him to be willing to offer, you know, to keep her actual lover alive for all these years, like tucked away as he, you know, fantasizes, you know, pines for her just outside of his like point of view or earshot. It's this ridiculous situation that he is kind of forced into, and I think that the movie is kind of commenting on the power that he can wield, but also how completely helpless he is to his own desire and how that kind of crumbles him as a person, even though he can still be domineering and, you know, a huge asshole often. But it's kind of this two-edged sword of he has power to wield, but it also takes something away from himself as well. I don't have the context for the revolution of Romania and how that, I mean, I assume there's some kind of connection here where this story of obsession and power and manipulation and this ownership, I'm going to guess that there's some kind of connection to the Romanian Revolution. What is that precisely? No idea. I couldn't tell you, but I will say that there's an energy to this movie that, I don't know, it feels, I don't know, I guess it's kind of giving him a pass. I don't know. I mean, I did like this movie, but I can't connect all the dots. I don't feel like I have the context to put these things together to really understand what he's on about, but I appreciate that it seems clear that he is on about something, if that makes sense. Like, I don't have all the answers, but this does seem like something that was actually constructed with some type of intention. Obviously that hasn't happened in our viewing experiences, because this movie is extremely hard to find in an incredibly poor condition where you can find it. So yeah, I mean, Criterion did their Wong Kar-wai box set, you know, last month or whatever. You know, I'll take it. Even put in the bad ones. Let's get Cold Heaven on Baby Blue, right? Why not? Let's get that restoration. Put them on Criterion Channel. Let's go. It's pretty wild. I mean, we've talked a lot about the fall for Rogue, but he has his like first five or six movies like revered. They're all available, easily available in these pristine editions. And then you get to some of these movies. Some of these late Rogue movies are the most obscure, some of the most obscure things I've seen out of the thousands of movies that I've seen. Like, you really have to dig around to find these random things. It's a weird one. This is maybe the most unique autobiography we've done, and we got one more to go, so we'll see where things ultimately end. But the, like, from a director trajectory, I don't think there's anything like this. Even when we talked about like Wells, you know, having movies taken away from him and so many of his projects were canceled, things like that, I still think there was a reverence to who Wells was and a recognition of, you know, his place in film history, even when he was still working. But by this point, for Rogue, it just seems like it's hard to see what impact these movies made at the time. And now they're basically completely forgotten, which is a pretty wild kind of trajectory for someone like Jericho said, major filmmaker. So pretty weird. But anyway.
I know. It's just one last thing, too, please. That's interesting about this film, and that is that even as perverse and pathetic and beholden and being held captive by their own obsessions, there's also a fascinating kind of a self-aware frankness to some of their discussions that I thought was, you know, not this is the most, you know, compelling depiction of obsession ever captured on screen, but you know, some fascinating conversations here where they're talking about how, they're completely indebted to their specific perversions, but then also how there's, you know, they find a certain freedom in at least knowing who they are and understanding themselves, which doesn't necessarily forgive the behavior, but there's something there. So it's also a somewhat decent script. Even though it can be a little much at times and absurd, but yeah, what a strange filmography that Nicholas Rogue has. And I did like The Witches. I forgot. I said I'd panned a bunch of them in a row, but I just remembered I really liked The Witches.
Witches is good. The Witches is good.
Funnily enough, the only one that I disliked.
Yeah.
Right.
What a world. And I know we're just getting back to Rogue after a couple of months off. So, or even more, like, what, it's been like 3 months since we last covered a Rogue movie on the show. So I know we're kind of waxing poetic on his filmography, but we do have one more. And this weird trajectory, I feel like, we can't write the story yet, because maybe one of the more interesting chapters is how it all ends. Because you have the two deaths in, or not the, just two deaths, it's cleaner, two deaths in 1995. Then he does a bunch of softcore porn, biblical stuff, straight to TV or video stuff, including The Adventures of Young Indiana Jones. And then 2007, 12 years later, he makes a movie called Puffball, The Devil's Eyeball.
How else would it end, my
which
friend?
Is a fantasy horror movie released in 2007. So, man, who knows what to
is that thing even available though?
I feel like it might be just as hard to find as two deaths, but we'll do our damnedest to talk. I mean, I will die before I skip over Puffball, The Devil's Eyeball. So I will have seen this by our next episode, or I will die trying, gentlemen. That's what I'm saying to you. All right, let's get out of here until it's Puffball time. That's going to do it for episode 172 of the Third Act Podcast. Thanks for hanging out with us. We're on Facebook and Twitter. You can email the show at thethirdactpodcast@gmail.com. We're just getting back into the swing of things after kind of a weird staggered hiatus. So we hope to get back to kind of a regular rhythm here. But movie releases aren't in regular rhythm, so not entirely sure what we're doing. We might check out this Pedro Almodovar short film with Tilda Swinton. That sounds like a good time. So we might talk about that. Whatever we do end up reviewing, Jericho's going to bring us a pairing film. And of course, the main event is going to be Puffball, the Devil's Eyeball. And then it's going to be time to pick our next auteur, which will be fun. So we'll figure out how that's going to go. But gentlemen, it's good to be back. Welcome back to the podcast. This was sorely missed by me. So glad to have everybody back in the house together.
Now we just got to convince Armando to stick around.
Armando, you sticking around?
And it's just haggling him on those reports, and just you can't break away. But we're your family, Armando. Capitalism will always be there. The boss will always be there, but you can't replace the pod.
Yeah, no, I'm loyal to you guys. I'm back on board. What are we doing next? Are we really gonna tackle this Almodovar? I'm feeling good about that.
It sounds great to me. It'll give me an excuse to maybe watch some other Almodovars as well, which would be nice. Oh, I said by our next episode, I'll have seen Puffball or Die Trying, but you know, that's only if I'm unable to convince Jericho that we must record a lengthy episode about the Snyder cut of Justice League. So, I mean, if the internet demands it, I mean, get out there, get the hashtags going, get some tweets out there.
He's working hard trying to convince me of this.
Snyder cut, just four hours, HBO Max, boom.
The Snyder snack box. Have you seen this thing? It comes with like movie treats and food. And on the branding of the box, it's like Zack Snyder with his hands crossed looking all like aggro.
This is real. Is this real?
Something. Yeah, it is an actual marketing thing.
Snyder
snack box. Where do you buy it? Like at the store?
The Snyder snack box. I came up with that term, but
where can I procure one?
I've been rolling around. Someone sent me a link to it, but I never really investigated like pricing. Wow. I saw the image and was, it could be a hoax, but I think it's real.
All right. I'll have to investigate. All right, that's going to do it. Remember that the greatest act of all is the third act of the rest of our lives. Make the best of it, and have a good night. I've got me to America.